It's the Philosopher's Zone, and today we're going to the movies.
I remember the first time I watched Hitchcock's Psycho was in an undergraduate philosophy and film class, and I remembered what stayed with me was the timeless nature of those psychological aspects of the film. It wasn't that you were scared of something external, but it was a very, very human element of the unknown and of the unpredictable nature of humans.
Unpredictable humans. They make for good films and even better philosophy. Can't say, though, that film and philosophers have always been good friends. The fear of mass mediocrity can be too much for some. But the sheer power of the medium to test out big ones can't be ignored. From reality in The Matrix to truth in Rashomon, film can be a virtual philosophical laboratory. And that's where we are today. For our final program of the season, I'm going to take a seat next to you. We'll get out the popcorn and hand over to this guest presenter.
I'm Dr. Laura DiLimpio, a lecturer in philosophy and ethics at the University of Notre Dame in Fremantle, Western Australia. My love of philosophical films began when I was 20 years old and I got a job working at the Astor Theatre in Mount Lawley. A job perk that I particularly enjoyed was being able to watch films for free outside of working hours. It was here that I first encountered Stanley Kubrick and many others besides. It was really interesting to see how different people responded to the same film. Some would walk out of films that others absolutely loved. Films provide this reservoir of narratives with which global audiences can engage. I see them as the common canon of our time, and in this way they provide a great source of stimulus material upon which we can reflect on the behaviour of characters and witness the values that society holds screened in front of us on this big silver screen. Art, of course, has always been a great way to picture and investigate the big questions in life, which is what philosophy does so well. By engaging with artworks like film, we can consider some of these classical philosophical questions, such as, how can we know that we are awake right now and not dreaming, not asleep, not being deceived by some evil demon, as René Descartes postulated? So instead of reading the philosophical thought experiment, perhaps we can watch films like The Matrix or Inception, and it's very much like learning about Plato's Allegory of the Cave or seeing a screened version of Nozick's Experience Machine. So philosophy and film can work very well together to explore some of these questions, such as, would you stay in a constructed reality or would you unplug and face the real world? And how can you tell the difference between them? When Neo in The Matrix is presented with the red pill and the blue pill, he's asked that exact question. And so films can help explore these philosophical ideas. Yet philosophers haven't always been happy to use film in order to explore philosophical ideas. For example, in the 1940s, with the Hollywood studio film in place and very strict censorship laws, many philosophers were worried about the nature of film and its mass-produced and mass-distributed nature. Adorno and Horkheimer were German theorists who had fled Nazi Germany and were very worried that the American mass art they were seeing springing up around them was going to end up being similar to Nazi propaganda due to its formulaic nature. This view started to change when different kinds of films started to be made, and these days we have much more variety with independent and art house films and much wider access to foreign language films as well. We also have auteurs like Woody Allen, Alfred Hitchcock, Michael Haneke, Sofia Coppola and others who make thoughtful films which in some cases deliberately draw upon philosophical ideas, so we can use these films to further investigate philosophical ideas that were traditionally presented in texts written by philosophers. I believe that all good art can teach us things. Just as we may be able to learn from the experiences of others in real life, films can share a story of someone's life vastly different from our own, and as viewers we can practice empathy and imaginatively engage with that story that is being filmed and screened in front of us. I have with me philosophy professor Michael Levine from the University of Western Australia, whose textbook with Damien Cox, Thinking Through Film, Doing Philosophy, Watching Movies, I actually use when teaching my film and philosophy course at Notre Dame University. Tell me, why do you think philosophers are interested in films?
Philosophical problems are not invented by philosophers. The locus of some very, very important and relevant philosophical problems is real life. And I think film has a way of capturing the nuances of real life that philosophy often misses. And I think that's why, for example, literature and film is often a tremendous introduction. It's what gets many philosophers interested in philosophy in the first place. I know it did with me, for example.
So when you think that people are watching these films, those philosophical questions are naturally arising because they're seeing human behaviour depicted on the big screen.
Yes, that's also, I would like to think, at least aside from the romance and the action, that people are interested in films, or certain films at least, because of their philosophical content. They don't have to read a philosophical treatise or a text or a journal article to be interested in philosophical issues. Let's face it, film is engaging and emotionally engaging as well as cognitively engaging in ways that very few of us manage when we write an article, a philosophical article. Film is extraordinarily powerful, and for that reason it can be used, like most powerful things, for good and bad, but it's certainly a way of engaging students.
That idea that films might be used for good or for bad is quite an interesting one. When you're looking at the films, do you think that there can be a divorce or an overlap between, say, the aesthetic and the ethical value of a film?
Well, this is a central question in contemporary aesthetics. If, for example, a film or an artwork in general, and so many do address moral issues, if they contain something that we might want to say is an immoral message or something off, for example, presents a racist point of view, not only presents it, but suggests that we take up that point of view, does that undermine the moral content of a work of art, undermine its aesthetic value? And there are those who say, no, one should absolutely keep them independent, that we can judge, for example, the beauty of a work and the aesthetic value of a work independently of the moral. And some people who claim that's just a narrow conception of what the aesthetic is and that the aesthetic has to accompany the moral. For my part, I do know that even if I like certain kinds of Schwarzenegger films, et cetera, certain kinds of adventure films, if the kind of worldview they're projecting, the kind of moral perspective that they're projecting, from my point of view, does undermine the overall value of the film. I'm not going to call it a great work of art, precisely because it engages aspects of me that I don't even like.
So the classical example of this that I'm thinking of is the Leni Riefenstahl documentary Triumph of the Will, which is meant to be a documentary about Hitler, and yet it's a piece of propaganda, really. It's meant to be aesthetically beautiful. It's shot with amazing cinematography. Hitler sort of descends from the clouds in the plane when he comes to land. And yet, of course, knowing what we know about the Nazi regime, it's morally evil. And so how do we judge this artwork?
I think it is a beautiful film. I think it's a cinematic masterpiece. Nevertheless, if we want to talk about it in terms of a work of art, we can't really discuss the film or engage with the film meaningfully unless we understand that it is glorifying the Nazis and it's doing something, despite the fact, by the way, of Riefenstahl's explicit denial of that. And what is one to say about a work of art that glorifies the Nazis? There's something aesthetically wrong with it.
So almost this theorising about the films, you say that they impact on you quite a lot. It's the thinking about it philosophically is trying to work out part of what that impact is, the nature of the film being so powerful. An example of that I was thinking was the kind of disaster film. There seems to be this enjoyment. There's all these films where the earth is at risk or there's going to be a major city being blown up. That is quite disturbing. But why do you think that people enjoy watching these kinds of films?
The first question, why there's this proliferation, I think one could do worse than read Susan Sontag's fantastic essay on science fiction films that came out in 1965. She says what these indicate really is society or people's existential fears and worries about nuclear war, about things that they didn't know. One of the things that these films are a manifestation of an underlying malaise or unease about the future, about what technology is going to bring, about ambiguous feelings toward science, toward technology, all of these kinds of things. And science fiction films are an expression of it. Now, if we come to, in contemporary terms, we see tornadoes, floods wiping out everything. How many times have we seen the Statue of Liberty go under, the Eiffel Tower, etc.? Again, many of these engage quite explicitly with the issues that are of great concern to many people today. And again, one mark of the science fiction film that Sontag discussed that again can be seen in contemporary catastrophe disaster films is they all offer facile, easy solutions. They don't seriously critically engage with the moral and political issues. They think that by being a good father or a good mother or something, the problems are, as it were, going to vanish. Very, very few films engage in a serious, critical manner. And this is where philosophy can come in, engage with a serious... Instead, their whole purpose, their whole function, and why we like to go see them is precisely because they give us these easy answers. They give us an immediate, albeit transient, kind of satisfaction.
And finally, you've done a lot of research into psychoanalytic theory, specifically the work of Sigmund Freud. Can you explain why psychoanalytic approach is so particularly well suited to interpreting and analysing films?
Look, I think psychoanalytic theory is much maligned in contemporary analytic philosophy. And yet I think that if psychoanalytic theory is right about certain kinds of basic things, I'll give you an example about the nature of prejudice as such. Now, some people will say prejudice is just, they'll give you an entirely cognitive account. We just have mistaken ideas about other races, about other religions. Psychoanalytic theory, no, says that prejudice, to understand prejudice, and there's a variety of prejudices, you have to understand it in terms of ego defense. Prejudice is really fundamentally about us and about who we are. Now, if psychoanalytic theory is more or less right about something like prejudice, you're never going to understand prejudice. You're never going to really fully understand the movie Avatar unless you understand something about the nature of prejudice. So if psychoanalysis is right about certain fundamental aspects of human nature, about character, about ego defense, about things that drive us, you cannot push all of that to one side, this psychoanalytic understanding, and still understand fundamental themes in certain films. Is it the whole answer, the whole story? Never. Nothing is. But I think it's central, and it's central because so many narratives in film are driven by these aspects of our nature.
Thank you, Professor Michael Levine from the University of Western Australia.
You believe I love you?
Yes.
And if you lose me, then you'll know I loved you and I wanted to go on loving you.
I won't lose you.
Let me go into the church. Alone.
Why?
We're at the Flicks today on the Philosopher's Zone with guest presenter Dr. Laura D'Olimpio of Notre Dame in WA.
One auteur who made his trademark by exploring the darker aspects of human psychology and the nature of fear is Alfred Hitchcock. I'm going to play a short clip now from Hitchcock's Vertigo that, even without the visuals, gives us a sense of how he uses music to create an atmosphere of suspense. This is the bell tower scene from Vertigo, where Scotty is following Madeline, but ultimately cannot overcome his vertigo in order to save Madeline from hurling herself off the church tower.
Madeline!
I have with me from the University of Melbourne, Hitchcock scholar and lecturer for the Melbourne School of Continental Philosophy, Mairead Phillips. Tell me, what do you think is philosophically interesting about horror films?
Well, of course, it's going to depend on the horror film. Hitchcock always wanted his audience to feel pleasure, the kind of pleasure that you get, that is, when you wake up from a nightmare. So it's not unlike the philosophical notion that's travelled through the centuries of the shipwreck with spectator metaphor. the one where watching a shipwreck from the shore can give the spectator a certain amount of pleasure because they're not involved in it themselves. What the concept does, however, and good horror films, that is, or films that deal with horror themes, is to call into question the neutrality of the spectator. And so depending on the director, the spectator may have a greater or lesser role to play in what happens on the screen. So Hitchcock always felt his spectators weren't just spectators, they were participants in the action. And an heir today of the films of Hitchcock would be a director like Michael Haneke, who deals directly with those kind of horror themes and the enjoyment we might get from them.
That sounds quite interesting, but it sounds almost perverse or like contradictory to say that we could enjoy scary films. The scary films that elicit negative emotions like fear could actually be enjoyed. Do you think that that is a strange concept?
Well, we only enjoy it when we know we're in complete safety. So when you're housed in the cinema theatre, you know the danger isn't going to affect you. So that's where the enjoyment comes from. It's that sense of safety. And once that is diminished, say you suddenly heard some sort of commotion going on outside or there was a bomb dropped on near the film theatre, that enjoyment would rapidly dissipate.
This idea that humans are emotionally and psychologically complex is something that Freud and psychoanalytic theory, I think, captures quite well. The idea that perhaps there's desires or intentions that we're not even consciously aware of ourselves that dictate some of our behaviour and our responses to situations. So does this psychoanalytic theory best explain the perverse desire of viewers to scare themselves by watching horror films?
I think you're right. Freud's discovery of the unconscious, that there is thought that is unconscious, that we don't always have a rational thought kind of in the tradition of Descartes, is really important and was what was so shocking. So I guess filmmakers that are interested in those unconscious drives and trying to show how they exist, cinema is a great way to be able to visualise that, so that sometimes you get the idea that with a filmmaker like Haneke, those kind of impulses can be personified even in a character. So the two boys in Haneke's Funny Games, they can be seen strictly as a kind of personification of the impulses to death, and basically it's to a death drive.
This idea of a death drive is quite a scary one. Do these kind of filmmakers believe that everyone has this impulse, or is it something that we only see when we're placed in an extreme scenario?
I think that the directors that are interested in it, you know, are interested in human nature. And so they probably feel in line with thinkers like Freud or philosophers like Nietzsche who explored this side of us and that don't see the world in black and white kind of categories, that someone is inherently good or inherently evil, that these kind of things exist within us in a combination and that all of us have some mixture of good and evil.
So these filmmakers are pointing out that everyone has a dark side, and maybe we'd even rather ignore this fact. This reminds me of a perfect example from Hitchcock's Psycho, and I'll play the clip here now where the protagonist, Norman Bates, gives his famous "We all go a little mad sometimes" speech.
People always call a madhouse someplace, don't they? Put her in someplace.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean it to sound uncaring.
What do you know about caring? Have you ever seen the inside of one of those places? The laughing and the tears. And the cruel eyes studying you. My mother there. But she's harmless. She's as harmless as one of those stuffed birds.
I am sorry. I only felt... It seems she's hurting you. I meant well.
People always mean well. They cluck their thick tongues and shake their heads and suggest oh so very delicately. Of course, I've suggested it myself. But I hate to even think about it. She needs me. It's not as if she were a maniac, a raving thing. She just goes a little mad sometimes. We all go a little mad sometimes. Haven't you?
I remember the first time I watched Hitchcock's Psycho was in an undergraduate philosophy and film class, and I remembered what stayed with me was the timeless nature of those psychological aspects of the film. It wasn't that you were scared of something external necessarily, even though, as you say, that embodies the fear, but it was a very, very human element of the unknown and of the unpredictable nature of humans.
Exactly, and it really shows up in how it differs from the genre horror that we get today, in that the violence isn't so much on the screen. Hitchcock, in the way he presents his shots, the way he shows character, it's putting the violence in the minds of the audience rather than on the screen. So once you have a kind of shocking murder, the shower scene, we don't really get another one until much later, and there the violence is sort of minimalised, but at no point is the audience not terrified through the rest of the film.
Yeah, so it's the fear of the unknown, and a lot of what is quite scary is not seeing everything, which is quite unusual for the cinema, big screen medium.
Someone said that the cinema is always haunted by what's not in it, and what you leave out is just as important as what you put into it.
Another trademark of the Hitchcock films that I particularly enjoy are his wonderfully strong female protagonists. It's a shame that they always end up suffering.
He has got some great female characters and, of course, some great actresses that played those characters. So his films with Ingrid Bergman are just divine. And I think when he's using an actress like Ingrid Bergman, he actually changes his film style. So we get a lot of close-ups, and it is more the films that he did with her, like Spellbound and Notorious, they are more about the psychological state of the heroine, and they follow her story. Later on, we see films with Tippi Hedren and in The Birds, probably mostly, and we see her suffer a lot. But I think films showing suffering, and it's not always the female characters, but I guess it is predominantly, it's important to have films that show this, because so much of life is forms of suffering. So I think that being able to explore how that happens, why, and then how to cope or survive with it is important.
One of the things that attracted me to look philosophically at films is that filmic narratives are so well known, and they often serve as great examples when discussing philosophical ideas. In a classroom environment, if I ask a first-year class if they've heard of Plato or Descartes, I might be met with blank looks. However, if I use a film as an example, there's usually a lot of interest. Making philosophical ideas accessible in this way is useful because it shows how philosophy is relevant to our modern everyday life. We can practice our critical thinking skills and even seek to avoid being purely passive viewers who unthinkingly ingest everything they are told or shown, which is one of the concerns that Adorno and Horkheimer had. One of my favourite films is Sofia Coppola's Lost in Translation. I love how much feeling is conveyed with such a small amount of dialogue. And Bill Murray and Scarlett Johansson are very endearing in their subtle portrayal of a dislocated, fleeting human connection that people sometimes have. I bet that you'll all be planning a movie night in the not-too-distant future.
One of my favourites too. Laura D'Olimpio was our guest presenter today, and she teaches at the University of Notre Dame in Perth. And as you can guess, one of her subjects is film and philosophy. Speaking of film, one of the sharpest programs is The Final Cut, which you can hear Thursday nights, Saturday afternoons, or online anytime. Just check the RN website. Time to roll the credits for the end of Season 1. The Philosopher's Zone was brought to you today by Diane Dean, Charles McCune, and me, Joe Gelonesi. Next week in the slot, the return of In Our Time with Melvin Bragg. Thanks for your company. See you in spring.